My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here at the annual Florida Chinese fire drill. But I'm glad to be here, really. I like Florida. I come here often. My subject today, I got to get going because I want to get done before the evening speaker, if I can. But, you know, sometimes people wonder all this fuss about singleness of purpose and everybody being a little bizarre and a little iconoclastic. I think you have to really begin to understand what it's about. I'm going to talk about that a little bit. You know, there seem to be types of alcoholics. We never mentioned around a much, but there seems to be types that I can see and most people know about. There's a type of alcoholic that's an alcoholic by any way you measure, and they drink and get in trouble and something bad things happen. But maybe they lose a job or they lose a family or somebody dies and they quit and they never drink again. And I know several people like this who used to drink badly and just found a reason to quit. And the same type of person, if they have become addicted to alcohol, which we don't ever talk about much either, the physical addiction to alcohol, which is a step beyond a regular alcoholism. We always talk about how bad it is to be narcotic addicted. Alcohol addiction is much more lethal than drug addiction. When you come off drugs, you get awfully sick. When you come off alcohol addiction, you many times die, smashing your head into the sidewalk. But these are the people for whom treatment centers were originally created, to medically withdraw them so they don't go through all that. In fact, there's still a big hospital in Seattle called Chic Chadel, where they advertise, "We will cure your alcoholism in 1 month." And they do it. They got a long list of names of this type of alcoholic who's been weaned, understand the nature of their problem, and they quit, and they never drink again. That's one type of alcoholic. Then there's another type of alcoholic who seems to be an alcoholic by any way you measure them. They drink and have problems, get in trouble. Something happens that really threatens their security. Maybe they lose a job or a family or somebody will die. And they quit. But they always drink again. And these same type of people come out of treatment centers with tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks. And they quit. But they always drink again. And this is the type of alcoholic that has baffled human beings for at least written records of 4,000 years and probably longer. These people who sometimes they care too much, sometimes they don't seem to care at all, they're just frustrating. At one time they thought they must be possessed by devils, they'd put them to death and flog them and beat them and send them away. And even for thousands of years, every conceivable type of therapy that people could think of, they've tried on these people, and nothing has ever worked. So long, as a matter of fact, that when I was a little boy up in Wisconsin, although I didn't know it and didn't care, there still was no reason. There was no way to stop drinking for these alcoholics. They just send them away or lock them in the back room or do something with them, but they nothing could be done. And that's why it's so remarkable that today sobriety is achievable for this type of people, because they're the type of people that come into rooms like this, people who cannot stay sober, who cannot maintain sobriety. And when I was a little boy, although I didn't know it, there was a wealthy family in New York who had a son who seemed to be plagued by nervous condition. Every time they were grooming him to run their big company, and he did very well, very bright, but he'd get terribly nervous. And when he got nervous, he seemed to drink alcohol, and he'd get drunk a lot. And they couldn't imagine why. So they decided, we got to do something about this. It was 1930, height of the Depression, but they had money. So they went to they found the best psychiatrist in the world. Is our starting time inconvenient? I thought it was. I thought maybe she thought it was too. I don't know. If anybody wants exposure, just walk by here. Anyway, so they found the best doctor psychiatrist in the world to send their son to. A lot of people don't know this, but they contacted Dr. Freud. And Dr. Freud refused to take the case for a couple of reasons, which is the first break we ever got. Yeah. Otherwise, we'd all be sitting here tonight drunk and saying, "But I dreamt I was sober." And so they had friends of the family took Roland over to Switzerland. They finally contacted Dr. Jung's ex-protege, Dr. Jung, and took him to, and Dr. Jung agreed to take him into his clinic in Switzerland. So they sent him over to Switzerland with his, and he was in this clinic apparently for a year. And Dr. Jung worked with him every day to break down the defenses, those things that are blocking his id, his ego. And finally, after about a year, he said, "Roland, I think you understand the nature of your problem now. You're all right to go home. I think you'll be all right." So Roland came home. He stopped in Paris, some very wealthy friends of his family, and they had a celebratory dinner because of his recovery. They toasted him with a glass of wine. 3 days later, he was face down drunk again, and everybody was just appalled. How can this happen? He knows the answer. Dr. Jung has told it to him, and he's drunk again. And so they took Roland back to Dr. Jung, and Dr. Jung said, "I'm sorry, I can't take him back in the hospital." "Why not? He didn't mean any harm. He's just something. He had a sudden attack of nerves." He said, "No, I know that. I'm not blaming him for anything, but I misdiagnosed his case. I thought he had deep psychological problems that I could help him with. But I see now he is in what is known as a chronic alcoholic. And to the best of my knowledge, there is no effective treatment for that condition today in the world at any price." That was 1931, not that long ago. And Roland, of course, was kind of thunderstruck. He says, "What does this mean, doctor?" The doctor said, "It means that you probably will have to keep yourself confined voluntarily or involuntarily as long as you live. Otherwise, you almost certainly will intermittently drink until you die or go mad." Bad news. He says, "Is there anything else, doctor? Is there any other way?" He said, "Well, there have been a few cases in the literature that I've read about where there seems to have been an involuntary psychological reversion. They call it some sort of a spiritual experience, but I've never seen one." He says, "I would think that your chances of being hit by lightning are better than this involuntary psychological experience." So Roland came home now, and he didn't stop in Paris for dinner. And he got on the ship. And I guess on the ship he did something, although he did never know it, I don't think. But something that people like us have to do if we're going to stay sober at all. He kind of came to the realization that he was hopeless and helpless. And there was no way to come out. And he came back. He thought, "What can I do?" He wrote later, he said, "I wanted to stay sober as long as I could, so when I died drunk, my parents would have a pleasant memory of me." You think that's funny? Wait till you get to the part where he dies. You like that one. Jesus Christ. Shed, I think you better get the car started. Tough crowd. This is a tough crowd. But he was already a vestryman in the Presbyterian Church. He was a fine, nice guy. He wasn't a loser, a bad guy. And he didn't know what to do. He thought, "What can I do to stay sober a while?" At that time, he stumbled onto something that began to help him. I'm going to tell you a little bit about that if you're new, because these things are kind of all come together just in blessings for us. In 1907, in Pennsylvania, there was a minister there named Frank Buckman. And he felt Christianity was getting too easy, getting too far away from its basic. You know, the first century, people were willing to be crucified for their faith. Uh-oh. There goes an agnostic. There's a chapter for you in the book. Yeah. But he felt that Christianity, in the first century, people were willing to be crucified upside down and burned at the stake for their faith. And now people felt it was too much bother to go to church on Sunday morning. And he wanted to get people involved again. So he started a little organization. He called it the First Century Christian Association, of making some sacrifices for your faith. And he didn't get a lot of takers. I don't, you know, just the concept. Do you want to come and be crucified upside down? No, I don't think so. And so after the First World War, he went to England, and for some reason, the students at Oxford University just grabbed this idea and thought it was the best thing in the world. They just competed to be how intense they could be in the new movement. So much so that it finally became known as the Oxford Group, although it didn't come from Oxford. And eventually after that, Frank Buckman came back to the United States, and with the blessings of the Oxford, overtones of the Oxford University, little groups formed all over the country, and it became very successful in the late 1920s, 1930, early 1930s. Was dead by 1937. It had turned into something else. But in that brief little period was the time that Buckman was riding high, and our friend Roland said, "That Oxford group, I bet that would help me." And what it consisted of, really, it was like a upper class est, is what it was. Nice people would sit around in private homes and discuss spiritual matters and how they could enhance their spiritual understandings. And so he went to the Oxford group, and he just blossomed. He just took off on it. Just wonderful. And he became a very strong member of the Oxford group. He stayed sober. His family was so thrilled. He was thrilled. After two or three years, his family said, "Roland, you're ready to take over the company, but why don't you take a little vacation first? Take some time this summer and go up to Vermont, to our summer home up there, and just relax." All right. And so in the middle of the summer, he went to Vermont. Now, there's no big deal there except for one thing. If he had gone 2 weeks later, we would not be here. Just a whole series of funny little coincidences. He got there, and as for he got there, he used to go there to use a boy with his family. One of the kids from his youth came over and said, "You know, Roland, our friend Ebby, one of our playmates, he's turned into an awfully drunk. And I know that you stopped drinking. Would you talk to him?" He said, "Sure, bring him around." So they brought Ebby to see Roland, and Roland tried to tell him about the Oxford group and the finding a power greater than yourself and involving yourself. And Ebby didn't want to hear that. He said, "I don't want to hear that, Roland." He said, "I don't want to hear that. I don't want to hear that." Roland said, "Okay." And a few days later, they came back and said, "Roland, you got to do something for me." Ebby got drunk and ran his car into a house, and he's on strict probation. They're going to send him to the penitentiary. He said, "Will you come and talk to the judge?" He said, "The judge is my father, but he won't listen to me. But he might listen to you because he knows your family and knows your father so well." So Roland, "Okay, since I'm here," and went to court, and just, "You know me, judge, you know my father, and I wouldn't certainly lie to you about anything, but I think there's an answer in the Oxford group, seems to me. Could you release him in my custody? And the judge says, "Only because it's you, Roland. I would do it for no one else, but I know your father, I know you. Take him, but you must take him out of Vermont, and if he ever comes back here, he'll go to the penitentiary." So Roland said, "Okay." So he took him to New York, stuck him in a place on Lower Broadway where the Oxford group was very big. And Roland said, "Now, we're going to keep you going. It's going to be all right, Ebby." Ebby said, "Okay." And he didn't really want to be there, but he didn't want to be in Vermont either. So one of the things in the Oxford group is after you were involved in it for a while, they asked you to testify. You'd go out and find someone and testify to them what you found. And Roland one day said, "Ebby, okay, it's time to testify, Ebby." "I don't want to testify. It's embarrassing enough to be here." He said, "You want to go back to Vermont?" "I think I'll testify." So then he had a brilliant idea. Who could I testify to? And he happened to think another boy of that Vermont group had moved to New York, had become a big drunk and a mooch and living off his wife and doing nothing and just a laughing stock. It had been something once, but was nothing now. He said, "I bet I could testify to that drunken puke, and he'd never even remember it the next day." So he looked up and found this guy, Bill Wilson, over in Brooklyn. And he called him up in our book. You know, in our chapter of our book is quite clear. He said, called up and came to see me. And he got to the door, and there was Ebby, sharp and sober. "God," Ebby said, "you look wonderful. What?" And Ebby said, "I found religion." And that ended the conversation as far as Bill was concerned. But they went and sat down. Bill has kind of dropped there in the book, but I heard Ebby describe it at a convention in 1960. And he had a little further addition to it. He said, "It just made me angry sitting there. I was talking, trying to help Bill. He drank as fast as he could." He said, "That's really wonderful, Ebby." So what he did, although Bill never mentioned it in the book, he came back 3 days later and he had the Oxford group closer with him. I want to talk to you, Mr. Wilson, about certain basic precepts that I think you'll find in him. And Bill said, oh, Jesus. And he did what any one of us decent people would do. He got drunker than ever. But then a few days later, he thought, well, maybe I should go over and talk to Ebby and see what's going on. So we went over to find him on Broadway. Got drunk on the way just to make sure he'd be all right. And got to this mission where Ebby lived, and Ebby wasn't there. But he gave a short sermon anyway just to help him out. Staggered on down the street. That night wound up back in the hospital again, town hospital. Doctor called Lois Wilson, Bill's wife, and said, I'm sorry to tell you this, but this may be Bill's last trip here. I don't think he has another trip left in him. He's dying. She said, oh my God, my God. She called up the mission. Ebby, she said, I know that Bill hasn't been very receptive, but they say he's very, very bad. Could you go up to the hospital and see him? She said, sure. He took a couple guys up there and he sat with Bill. He said, Bill, you got to find a power greater than yourself. You can't do it on your own. He said, I don't want to hear that religious crap. You know better. Okay. So they went home. In the middle of the night, this goofy, ne'er-do-well mooch living off his wife without any apparent reason to get any sort of a blessing from anybody woke up in the middle of the night and said, if there's a God, show yourself! And all of a sudden, it seemed to him as though a light lit out of the room and a wind blew. And he said, my God, I'm going insane. I can't, what is this? But pretty soon it dimmed down again and he felt different and then told the doctor anymore. He said, doctor, did I have a psychiatric breakdown? He said, no, I don't think so, Bill. I'm looking at you. Something has changed in you, though. Whatever you found, I hope you stick with it. It turned out this guy, for no apparent reason, apparently had a true spiritual experience. Not based on merit or anything else, just based on random almost. And he came out of that hospital and he went to the Oxford group to be with Ebby and get involved. You think, well, what's all this other stuff about Ebby and Roland and all that stuff? Because all of those were necessary. Because the very few people who ever got spiritual experiences, they went into the church, did church work. He somehow associated with Ebby trying to get him to stop drinking. So he went to the Oxford group. And he stayed in the Oxford group. He was very active. He just, as his strength came back, and he was a bright guy, and he stayed sober, and he was active. He was bringing street drunks to the meetings so they could get some spiritual values. And of course, the people in the meetings were not exactly thrilled about this. Nice little old people sitting there. I believe you're vomiting on my shoe, sir. And he'd bring him home sometimes and bring him home, see if he could talk to him at night about finding Jesus or God. And this went on for 6 months. And one morning Bill got up at his home and, over in Brooklyn, and the guy he'd brought home the night before had left early, taken some stuff out of the house to sell for wine, apparently, which had happened several times. He looked at his wife, who'd been a chic little society girl when he married her, now reduced to being a counter girl in a cheap department store, putting on her little sweater with a patch on the sleeve and prematurely old. He suddenly realized, what's all this crap I've been trying to do? This doesn't do anything for anybody. I thought I had some vision to help people. I've got any vision, just some psychiatric breakdown. He said, Lois, I want you to know I'm going to change. I hope that you don't have to go to work much longer. I'm going to get a job no matter what it is, and I'm going to take care of you instead of you taking care of me. And we're going to have a normal life, and it's going to be wonderful. And he said, I thought I had some way to help people, but I've been trying to help people for 6 months, and not one person has stayed sober, and it's over. And right there, your life and mine hung by as thin a thread as you'll ever have it hung by, I'll tell you. And she turned and said something to him that changed the course of history. I was having lunch with her many years ago in Connecticut. I said, Lois, how did you ever think of that answer? God had really changed the course of everything. She said, I don't know, it just seems so obvious. He said, when he had said, I've worked with people for 6 months and not one person has stayed sober. And she said, you did. Oh, yeah. That's why old timers don't have much hair in front. You go. It's a lifetime of, oh, yeah. So he decided to try a little bit longer. And what a blessing. He went down to the doctor at Towns Hospital and said, I'm trying to help these people, but none of them are being helped. Apparently, I can't get anybody to stay sober. And yet I have a feeling I can help them. The doctor says, you're going at it all wrong, Bill. He said, the one thing you have to offer these people is to make them feel you may know how they feel and why they drink. Instead of teaching them religion has never kept an alcoholic sober in all these thousands of years. But try to talk to them about how you feel and what happens. He said, that's a good idea. I'll try that. And just in time, then someone offered him a job. Why don't you go to Akron, Ohio, get some proxies for this company out there, and get them together, vote right. You'll be president of the company, Bill, and here's your big chance. But if you blow this, don't even come around again, because we're not going to monkey around with you. So Bill went off to Akron, Ohio. The deal blew up in his face. And now he knew not only was he a failure, but he was going to stay a failure. So he stood in his hotel in May morning, hot May morning, 1935. Looked in his pocket. He had $10. He could either pay his hotel bill or buy a train ticket home. He didn't know what to do. And he just didn't know what to make of anything. And over here, I stood in that lobby some years ago trying to recreate what a feeling that must have been. Over here, there's a door with a curved sign over it that said cocktails. And there's music coming out of there. And as he wrote later, I knew if I just had one or two drinks, I could find an answer. And he started to go to that bar. And our lives went right along with him, boy. And out of the corner of his eye, he saw some telephones against the wall. In small town hotels, I don't know if they still do it or not, but they have a bank of telephones and over in the local churches and their ministers. And he remembered that he had promised to call an Oxford group member before he drank or did anything rash. So he thought, well, I'll go over there and try it. He called the first name up there. Said, I'm Bill Wilson. I'm a rum hound from New York, and I need to talk to a member of the Oxford group. Maybe he's a drinker. The minister said, I don't know what your problem is, sir, but I'm trying to write a sermon. Please don't bother me. Hung up. Called the next guy. Nobody answered. Called the next guy who had nothing to tell him. Called the next guy. Nobody answered. And that's it. I'm sure you understand as I understood. I would have said, I believe. Well, I did what I said I'd do. And maybe I just get one or two drinks and I'll be all right. But you saw at the bottom of the list, there's a funny little name down there. Walter Tunk. So I'll call Walter Tunk, see what he's got to say. And Walter Tunk said, funny you should call. I was just talking to one of my parishioners. She told me that her doctor last week in the Oxford group admitted he was an alcoholic and needed help and didn't know where to get it. Stay right there. Let me see what I can do. So Bill waited in the phone booth, and he called the woman who had been married to the heir to the Goodyear Rubber Company, still lived in the property in a big mansion. And he said, there's a man downtown who is an Oxford group member looking for someone, maybe your doctor, to help with his drinking. She said, oh, wonderful, let me call. And she called Dr. Bob's house, this drunken doctor. And the wife said, I'm sorry, we can't do anything today. He's laying drunk on the floor underneath the coffee table, and he's just drunk. And I'm so angry at him. Incidentally, if any of you ever saw on Broadway a movie called Dr. Bob, Bill W. and Dr. Bob, there's a scene in there that it just shocks you. But he's laying on the floor drunk, and she comes over and starts kicking him. She said, you son of a bitch, you son of a bitch. You know, you don't think of that. You think of these people as being kind of saint-like creatures. Come along, Bob. I guess people were the same then as they are now. And anyway, She said, "We probably can get together tomorrow." So she called the woman back, and the woman called the minister back, and the minister called the Bill back. Just stop. The one thing in there, though, just stop and think. If any one of those people hadn't been home, we wouldn't be here. Just little, tiny, little, dumb little things. And so they made an agreement to meet at this mansion on the next day, which was Mother's Day of 1935. And she gave instructions to Bill and how he could take the streetcar out there. And Dr. Bob came out with his family. He was so hungover and sick. Some of you have heard his son, knew his son. I knew him quite well, named Smitty. They called him Smitty. He was not an alcoholic. He was Al-Anon. He kept marrying alcoholic women. We know he was funny. There's only one thing worse than marrying alcoholic women. That's marrying non-alcoholic women. I don't mean that's my opinion. I'm just repeating what I've heard. Yeah. But he used to tell me what it was like driving out there that day. His father was too drunk or too sick to drive, so he drove. He was 16. And his sister sat next to him in the back, his mother and father. And his father, "I'm so sorry, Ann. I'm so sorry I ruined Mother's Day. I didn't mean to do that." He said, "I'll go out there and I'll give this guy 15 minutes because I love you, but I'm not going to sit and listen to any more sermons. I'm so sick of sermons, I can't stand it." So they got out there, introduced these two guys. Eventually they went into a little side room to talk. And the 15 minutes turned into 30 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours. Finally they came out and the doctor was just, he looked different. He said, "And I can't believe it." He said, "That man is the first man that I ever heard who seems to know how I feel and why I drink. I can't believe it." And he said to Bill, "Bill, could you possibly stay out here just a couple of weeks and we could talk about spiritual matters and get the Oxford group firmly planted in me?" And Bill thought, "Let's see. I have nowhere to get out of town." "Yes, I can stay." So they sat and for 2 weeks. They just discussed spiritual values and deep spiritual values and how they could enhance their beliefs and how they could be a... At the end of 2 weeks, the doctor said to Bill, he said, "Bill, this weekend I want you to stay here with my wife and kids. I'm going to Atlantic City to the American Medical Association convention. I was there last year and I was so drunk and they ridiculed me. I just felt so cheap. But I'm going this year and I'm going to be clear-eyed and bright and sharp. And I'll be back Monday and this is a great moment for me." So off we went. Monday morning about 7 o'clock the phone rang at the Smith house. And a woman on the line said, "Hello, Mrs. Smith. I'm so sorry to make this call, but this is Dr. Bob's nurse, office nurse. They called me from the station this morning. Dr. Bob was so drunk they carried him off the station and laid him on the platform. And the station agent called me and I got down and got him. I got him up to his office. Now he's laying on the floor crying and drunk." She said, "I know he was trying so hard and I'm so sorry. What should I do?" And she said, "Well, we'll come down and get him and bring him home." So they went down and get him. "I'm so sorry. I'm sick of hearing it." Brought him home, put him to bed. And the big experiment was over. And on Wednesday morning, Bob suddenly said, "What day is this?" He said, "It's Wednesday, Bob." "Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I've got to do a cancer surgery today and I can't. I can't hold a knife. My God, I'll lose my license. Oh my God, what can I do?" So they got him up and they bathed him and dressed him. His new friend Bill got him a couple drinks to steady his hand. And he went off to the hospital and said, I'll be back about 1 o'clock if this goes well." And they waited for him at 1 o'clock and he didn't come. Or 2 o'clock, or 3 o'clock, or 4 o'clock. Everybody knew the son of a bitch was drunk again. 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, suddenly the car pulled up. Dr. Bob bounded in, just sober as a judge, glowing. He said, "Where have you been, Bob?" He said, "It's the funniest thing. As I was doing that surgery, I was thinking about the Oxford group saying, that you have to make amends. And I never thought a doctor should have to make amends, but I realized everybody has to make amends. And I've been making amends all afternoon and all over Akron, and I feel wonderful. And that was June 10th, 1935, which we consider the birthday of Alcoholics Anonymous. But the thing that changed was this. They realized sitting around talking about spirituality is not what had kept Bill sober. He was trying to help people. And he told the doctor about this. The doctor said, well, I have this friend up in, who's a nun up in the hospital, and I think she's got a guy up there, a lawyer. They won't let him in for alcoholism. They have him in for gastritis, but it's alcoholism. And so they made arrangements to talk to her if they could talk to this guy. And the nun said, well, you'll have to talk to his wife. She's a very strong woman. So they went to talk to her. I heard Bill, the guy's name was Bill D. He was a lawyer from Louisville who had gone, moved to Akron to get away from his drinking, which of course didn't work. And he was speaking at a convention. He said, I was laying on that bed in Akron, Ohio. And my wife came in and said, two fellas want to talk to me about my drinking. I told her, I don't want to talk to anybody about my drinking. I'm sick of talking to people about drinking. It doesn't do anything except make me feel bad. But my wife's a very strong woman. And I talked to them two fellas. And the funny thing is, they never talked about my drinking once. They talked about their drinking and how they felt. And I never, ever heard anybody describe me like that before. I was so impressed. I stuck with them fellas, and I've been with them ever since. He became the third in the chain. Then they had some difficulties around town. They were trying to help drunks, and drunks didn't want to be helped, and it was on and on. One of the interesting little things, after a while, they had about four or five people. They weren't going to AA meetings. They were going sitting in one section of the Oxford group. But there's a young guy, a guy named Ernie, and he was only 29 or so. They said, you probably can't be an alcoholic at 29, but you have been drinking a lot, so maybe this can help you. So they had guided him into their little movement. And Ernie, of all things, fell in love with Dr. Bob's daughter. And although they had no idea of it at the time, that action would thunder down the halls of AA for many, many years. He brought us our first relationship. I know of no word that sends a shudder down a sponsor's spine than that one. I want to talk to you about my new relationship. Take the phone, put it on the aha machine, and walk away. They really fell in love and they got married. And I've talked about this before, but it's a significant thing. That happened in my family. My youngest daughter, Susan, fell in love with a guy I sponsored who was about 5-6 years sober that I did not particularly care for. But they decided to get married. No one checked with me. What does he know? So I checked with my sisters, my mother, they know. So they got married. And I'll tell you the absolute epitome of mixed emotions. It's watching your daughter go down the aisle to marry a man whose fifth step you've heard. You can't really say anything, but you can give hints, you know. Let me know if he ever brings a sheep home. Jesus. At any rate, they got married, and they said, gee, Ernie, you know, you should really take care of your new wife now. You don't need to be running around the Oxford group and going to helping drunks and so on. You stay home, take care of your wife for a while, and we can move on without you. So they were saddened when he got drunk and died and turned her against AA for 50 years. But little by little, they got some people. And Bill went back to New York, got a few people there. And eventually, they thought, what do we have to do now? We have to find a way to get a hospital built where we don't have to have the Oxford group influence. We love the Oxford group, but they just want to talk about religion. We have to talk about what we have in common. That how could I get some money to build a hospital? Well, we'll write a book explaining how we got these people sober, and then money will just pour in and we'll build some hospitals. And so Bill Wilson, with aids and assists, and many people think assists from God, wrote the book Alcoholics Anonymous in 1938. And I'll tell you a funny thing. I forget sometimes. I had a chance to see Bill Wilson in 1963. I was in New York working, and I thought I'd go see Bill Wilson. And I went up there and I said, can I see Bill Wilson? No, he's booked all day long. Okay. So I was moodily looking at the archives, and old Bill walks in there. I said, you young man want to see me? I said, yeah, I am. He said, well, my 11 o'clock appointment didn't show up. Come on in. So we talked for an hour. I'm afraid I talked more than he did. But I was trying to express my gratitude because I was finally staying sober after so many years. And but I said, you know, there's one thing I don't understand, Bill. In our book study group in Los Angeles, we just got done working with others. And you talk a lot in there about what you say to the new man and how to make him identify, but you never mention once take him to a meeting. Don't you people in New York take people to meetings with newcomers? He said, young man, when I wrote that book, there were no meetings. Just people take him to the Oxford group where they get religion. So you had to talk to him one-to-one to get some identification. And they grew little by little. The book didn't sell very well, so they didn't do much with it. But the book has certainly become a great thing. You know, it's an interesting thing. The book was not received well. When you get new in AA, you read the big book. It does nothing for you, really. I got sober first time, and my sponsor had me read the big book. And I read it, and they always said, well, it's not a very well-written book. It is a well-written book. Not bad. Its problem is it's just terminally dull. Jesus. And some years later, when I came off Skid Row, not my fault. My new sponsor had me read the book again. I said, I read the book. I had no front teeth, so I read the book. He said, well, read it again. So I read it again, and I realized I had really forgotten about the book. I had misjudged it. It was much duller than I remembered. My job in life when I was successful was writing things to get people to take action. Buy this product. Do this. Take this. And I remember. You read that book looking for something. And if you are thorough at this stage of your development. And yet there are people who I've heard over the years say has a temerity to say that they call this book a miracle. That is a word that is really overused in AA, miracle. I mean, I heard a guy a few years ago said, I got up early this morning, and I looked in the eastern sky, and the sun was coming up. And I said, it's a miracle. I've been given another day of a wonderful program. Oh, Jesus. Get up early tomorrow and have another one, you goof. Miracles are supposed to be inexplicable, not explainable. They're supposed to be something you can't explain. Why would they call the book a miracle? Because the years went by and I became a strong fan of the book, and now a great fan of the book. It became clear to me why it's a miracle. First of all, it was written by a man who did not know enough to write it. He had no background in psychology, abnormal psychology, medicine, nothing. And he wrote this book, which combines a number of things. He was 3 years sober. Now, if you're kind of new, you might think, gosh, by the time you're 3 years sober, you should know enough to write a book by then. You'll discover that you don't when you're 3 years sober. By the time you're 5 years sober, you just try to be kind to people 3 years sober. Hang in there, Jimmy. By the time you're 10 years sober, you hate to send people 3 years sober to get your coffee, you know. Is that one cream and two sugars or two sugars? Never mind. By the time you're 20 years sober, you hate to have people 3 years sober unattended on your property. And this boob wrote a book, badly accepted at first, often ridiculed by new members. that changed the lives of more people of our type of alcoholic in the last 69 years than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. That is a miracle. But he wrote the book. It didn't do very well, and they had to finally get their name out. Bill was back in New York. 1939, there's a little magazine called Liberty Magazine. When I was a boy, I used to sell it for a nickel a copy. And they wrote an article in there about AA, and it turned out very unfortunate because they made it sound like a religion. Whoever wrote it and made AA look worse than it was. In 1940, the end of 1940, the Saturday Evening Post had a guy who specialized in uncovering corruption. And he just finished a great series on the corrupt Philadelphia labor movement. And his next assignment, work into this AA thing and find out about it. Let's really blow the whistle on these people. So he did it. And much to his surprise, he discovered they were just what they said they were. No one was making any money. Everybody was trying to help people. Almost, he said, it's like practicing Christianity. I never saw it work before. And they published in March of 1941 this article, and it took the nation by storm. Nobody ever had the answer that they could talk about in a family where there's one of these alcoholics. And there was bombarded New York by letters, and what can we do? And Bill would sit there and dictate letters by 18 hours a day and send them a book, and here's what you can do, and here's what we do, and on and on. And by 1942, AA was all over the country. 1943, all over the country. But now we're starting to get some letters saying, I don't know why, Bill, but our group is dying out. Our group, take us off your list. We just don't have meetings anymore. By 1944, more and more groups were died. By early 1945, Bill was at wit's end every day looking at the mail, another two groups, another three groups, another town. And so what he did, he started the Grapevine. And he thought that would bring people together. He was in the shape of this big at that time. And it helped a little, but not much. By spring of 1945, it looked like AA was about to become extinct almost. And a doctor in North Carolina wrote an article and sent it in to Bill. He said, I don't know if you know about this. I stumbled onto it. He said, you may find it interesting. And Bill read this article and discovered there had been a group almost like AA, just 100 years before. In 1846, drunks had got together in a bar in Baltimore, one was just out of jail. He said to his friends, he said, you know that chaplain down there? He says he knows how I feel. He doesn't know how I feel. You guys are the guys know how I feel, and you're drunk as much as I am. So they took a vow. They're going to help each other stay sober. They drew up a little constitution, and they signed it. Elected five officers, one member. That sounds about right. Who do you identify with? And people ridiculed me. You drunken bastards can't even stay sober yourself. You're going to help each other. No, that's funny. But they stayed sober, and a few people joined them. Some people from Philadelphia heard about it and came down and took it back to Philadelphia. People came from Washington. People came from Baltimore. People came from Boston. At the end of the year, they had several hundred sober drunkards of our type. And entertainment in those days was consisted of mass meetings. They'd have a lecture convention. There was no television, no phone, no radios, no movies, no nothing. It'd be a play or some speaker. Speakers were very big in that time. And they got a couple drinking speakers and got them sober. So they went out and talked up what they had found. And by the second anniversary, they accepted they called themselves after George Washington. They said, well, no one's ever stayed sober helping other drunks. So we're first of a kind. So they called themselves the Washingtonians. And they took Washington's birthday as their anniversary. At the end of the second year, they sent a letter to every chapter they could find and said, you know, in your community, try to get someone who's a young opinion maker, not a big celebrity or anything, and have them come in and talk to you on our anniversary. Not that we need to hear what they got to say, but because people think we're goofy and crazy, and they'll see that we're doing a good job. So all over the country on February 22nd, 1842, in Springfield, Illinois, they brought in this young lawyer named Abraham Lincoln, who gave a talk. And If you ever read a book on Lincoln's speeches, you'll find a talk to the Washingtonians, 1842. And he didn't know what to make of it. Most of it just boilerplate. But when he wound up saying, you know, I know most of you men. I've worked with you. And you're sensitive, intelligent, good workers. But I've never been able to understand your thirst. It's something I'm not can conceive. But I'm so glad you're staying dry now without drinking that devil stuff. And by 1845, they had grown so big, the estimate of their membership in the United States was 100,000 sober alcoholics. When you stop and think, there'd never been any sober alcoholics of our type before, and here's 100,000. And then the leaders of the Washingtonians got together and came upon some thoughts. That sounds kind of strange, but they think people in AA think the same thing today. If we're able to help drunkards, we should be able to help all sorts of people. People who use narcotics but don't use alcohol. People who have emotional problems. We should get involved in politics. We should start working in the anti-slavery movement. We should help get Texas to be a state. We should work on the absolute forbiddance of alcohol in the world. And they really all got into it. And they found just this great intensity, and they found ways to help people. By 1848, the Washingtons were extinct. And with very few exceptions, they all died drunk on the street. I had a book home written in 1861 by one of his few survivors that don't know what happened. We were doing so well. But people got so busy doing things, they didn't have time to help drunkards anymore. So they helped. And one by one, they all went down. And Bill Wilson wrote this, read this, and saw what had happened. And he went down and got some books in the library. He had never heard of the Washingtonians. And he saw how similar they were and what had happened in so many ways. They had fought for prestige. Who's going to get the most credit for what you're doing? Who's going to do these things? Who's going to get the most money out of this? On and on. And in a desperate last gasp attempt to save AA, he sat down and wrote the 12 traditions based on the Washingtonian experience as well as the AA experience. And he issued them one by one in the grapevine, this new grapevine. And unfortunately, in the long form of the traditions, I don't know if any of you are not familiar with them, but in the back, across from the short form, there's a long form, which fleshes them out, which really talks about it. In our group in Los Angeles, we read the long form once a month, so newcomers know what it's about, because it tells why. But Alcoholics Anonymous had a problem then, they have now, and we don't know how to get rid of it. It's full of alcoholics. And a lot of people didn't want to hear the traditions. We don't want your traditions. We don't want your goddamn laws. We're here for love. Yeah. And Bill, maybe you read about this, Bill got on his motorcycle and put Lois in the sidecar and traveled all over the East Coast explaining to groups what the traditions are not rules or laws. They're trying to save us. And some people got it and some people didn't. By the 1949, there were still a bunch of pockets of resistance. And Bill, interesting thing, Bill was in Akron, or in New York, Dr. Bob was in Akron, and they got along splendidly. Their followers didn't get along very well. They still don't. People in Akron think, a bunch of New York highbinders, and New York say those Akron shit kickers. But the Akron group stayed closer to the Oxford group. They didn't break away quite so much. They still use the Oxford group for absolutes and so on. But they said to their followers, they said, let's have a meeting somewhere where people from all over the country can come and we'll talk to them about what we're doing. Okay. People in Akron said, we'll go to a meeting. We won't go to New York. And the people in New York, not to be outdone in spirituality, we'll go to a meeting. We won't go to Akron. So Bill and Dr. Bob got together and said, Cleveland. All right, we'll go there. So in July of 1950... the first and largest group of alcoholics of our type, other than those few in the Washingtonians, got together in a meeting in Cleveland, Ohio. First time that many alcoholics of our type sitting sober in a room. And I have the tapes of that convention. They're very poor quality, but the content is wonderful. But they were still concerned, like the Washingtonians were. people don't think we're kind of crazy. So most of the speakers were non-alcoholics. The warden of San Quentin, some people in the government, people talk about how wonderful AA was. But Bill and Dr. Bob also talked. And Dr. Bob at that time was dying. He was dying of cancer. And they said, "You probably don't want to talk, Bob." He said, "Oh, I've got to talk. I'm 15 years sober. I'm the second oldest sobriety in the world." So on that day, his son and a friend took him to the tall gong and to the podium. And he gave just kind of a, you know, "Welcome to Cleveland. I want to welcome all of you here. And hope you go back and tell the boys and girls in the groups that what you get out of AA is what you put into it." He said, I'm very happy that some small thing I did years ago helped bring this about. He said, I want to apologize for my health. I've been in bed most of the past few months, and my health hasn't returned the way. You know, just, but then, he said, "But I do want to call your attention to two or three things that I think are important." And he gave then what many people conceived to be the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's rung down the history of, certainly. And he, and the reason why I think, because he was a much better 12-stepper than Bill was, actually, and he had such strong beliefs. He worked day and night in Akron on alcoholics, and he knew he was dying, and this is almost like a dying testament. He knew he wouldn't be around much longer, and he had to convey what he believed. Simply, he said, "First, let us remember to keep our program simple. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientific mind, but have nothing to do with our work here. Our work here, when reduced to the last, consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And secondly," he said, "let us guard that erring member, the tongue. Try to treat it with decency. There isn't a person in the world, in this room or any room like this, who doesn't know exactly what he meant. You know, when things are our way, it's all very nice. Love is the answer, baby. But let somebody hurt our feelings." Then you can give them the ultimate curse. "I don't even think that son of a bitch is alcoholic." That's the way we spent our whole life trying to avoid that term, and now you're not even an alcoholic. "Yes, I am. Yes, I can prove it. I can prove it." And finally, he said, "None of us would be here today if someone hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a pat on the back when we need it, to take us to a few meetings, perhaps. Let us never reach that stage of smug complacency when we are no longer able to help our friend who suffers in black alcoholic despair." And he sat down. He was dead shortly thereafter. But that's what he said there is as true today as it ever was, ever will be. It's always the same thing. We fight against ourselves. And a little by little, A grew. And one of the things the last thing in that program, they had 6 young guys. They gave them each two traditions. To explain, these are not rules, these are not laws, these are suggestions to save us. And we don't have a police force, we can't punish you. Which some of us old-timers think may have been a mistake. Where I live, as unfair as it is, I am known as a dictator-type sponsor. That I tell people what to do, I don't share with them. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. But, you know, people forget you can be a dictator sponsor, but it requires the 100% approval of the dictatee. All he has to say is, "Screw you." And the dictatorship is over. And, wouldn't it be nice if we had people come at night and say, "Did you say screw you to your sponsor? Come with us to the camp." But they accepted the tradition. And an interesting thing, there was such a wave against them, Bill Wilson, even after all that, wasn't sure they'd be accepted. And he winds up, you know, he says, "You now heard the traditions read. Seeing no objections, they're accepted. And they saved us. And little by little, AA has grown. And now it's in 137 countries. And everybody comes to AA just knows there's AA everywhere. Every town that's got a stoplight, it's got an AA, viable AA meeting. And we continue and we hear the same arguments. Why do we have to keep doing the same old traditions crap? Maybe we should go beyond them. But the one thing you look back in all that history of AA, first of all, let's go start with this premise. In the book Alcoholics Anonymous, there's nothing new. It's all a compilation of things from other places. There's nothing in there that should enable people to stay sober if it didn't somewhere else. What made it work? And was this. People like you and me have not very many things in common, but there's one thing we come to AA with in common, usually. I know that my case is different. I know you don't really understand, and I know you mean well, but I've been listening to people my whole life say, I know how you feel, and I know they don't. What has made AA work is somehow, as Bill Wilson did with Dr. Bob, talked about himself, not about them, and got that miracle called identification. And one by one, ever since then, that's the only thing that has lifted AA beyond any other attempted therapy. Identification. Identification. It gets through that wall when nothing does. And that is why in 1958, for example, when I got sober, there was a guy I knew who was an AA member and a gambler, and he's bringing his gambler friends to AA, and we don't want to go to share those goddamn juicers anymore. They're coming. So he wrote to New York and asked them for permission to use the 12 steps to form Gamblers Anonymous. And first organization ever built like that. And it went off so well, it became just wonderful. It just took off. It's still the most successful of all the non-AA 12-step programs. But a funny thing happened in the mid-1960s. He was a good friend of mine. His name was Jim Willis. He was so active in GA. You know, his pictures were on the wall, like Bill and Dr. Bob's were on ours. And he just didn't have time to go AA anymore. So people got very sad when he got drunk and died. But as they say in GA, he never gambled again, which is what they cared about. In 1960, some guys in North Hollywood, kind of bad bunch, they were trying to bring their heroin addicts to meetings. Man, what's that? I don't want to hear that. Shit, you know. So they wrote to New York and got permission to use the 12 steps and founded Narcotics Anonymous. And then some people in West Side of L.A., all this happened in L.A. within a period of a few years, got permission, a lady who had a terrible eating problem, additional alcoholism, got permission to form Overeaters Anonymous. Then they formed Cocaine Anonymous, which are still the big four, and all over the world. They're based on one thing only. The only reason they formed these things so that the guy coming in could identify. All the information in the world doesn't help if the door is locked. Never has helped anybody. That is what makes AA so remarkable. I'll tell you where I really begin to understand that at a visceral level. When I was about 2 years sober, I was finally staying sober after slipping for 10 years, 11 years. And I had no front teeth. I weighed about 129 pounds. Boy, I was on fire. I was talking one day at the club on obsessions. I'm an authority on obsessions, not how to recover from them, just the obsessions. And this lady came up after her, she says, "That's remarkable. I never heard anybody talk about those obsessions before." She said, "I've just formed a group called Overeaters Anonymous. Would you come over and talk to our ladies at the Christ the King Church on Olympic Boulevard Sunday?" I said, "Sure." "Show them how skinny you can be." So I went over there, and there's about 9 plump women sitting around a table. And I gave them a great talk on obsessions. They just him. And when I got done, I sat down. I thought it really helped him. Then they had a little sharing session. And I couldn't believe my ears. Woman over here, her son had just turned 10. He was at a military school in Long Beach. She sent her husband down to pick him up in Long Beach, bring him back for a little party. She had this cake she bought. She took it out, took a little piece to make sure it was good, had one more little piece, By the time they got back, she'd eaten the whole cake. And she felt so bad about it. She just, and they were all, oh, poor dear, I understand that. And I didn't say anything because I'm too nice a guy. But I wanted to say, why don't you just have a piece of cake and forget it, for Christ's sake? What's wrong with you? Woman over here talking about ice cream. She's into ice cream. Oh, I eat ice cream. When my husband leaves to work, I go down and buy ice cream, and I just love it. It seems the only thing that makes me feel good. I just love ice cream. And on and on. I didn't say anything. Nice guys. I thought to myself, no wonder you're fat, for Christ's sake. You eat 5 gallons of ice cream a day, you're liable to get fat. But my favorite was over here. This woman ate till she couldn't eat anymore. Then she put her finger down her throat and vomited it up so she could eat some more. And I didn't say anything because I'm too nice a guy, but I said, don't bother shaking hands after the meal. I mean, I can see doing that for drinking. I've done that a lot for drinking, but not for eating, for Christ's sake. Saturday afternoon, still light. Jesus. What was the difference? I'm smart. I understood exactly what they were saying. I just didn't identify it. It was just meaningless information. And that's what makes AA work. And that's why, again and again, you go back to Bill and Dr. Bob and all the folks in between, Bill D. up in the hospital, the thing that has made AA viable and successful is identification. Without that, we have information which has not worked for 4,000 years. And that's why we stress singleness of purpose. Alcoholics, talking to alcoholics. Because the bottom of all this whole enormous structure, the bottom line is, as it has always been, one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of difference at least enough that he will begin to take actions that he does not yet believe in. And when that moment comes, the miracle starts. Let us protect singleness of purpose. Thank you.